Welcome, everybody. It's Thanks, Good Talk, a short cast by the Hogan Lovells Government Relations and Public Affairs team. I'm Ivan Zapian, and I'm here today with my co-host Tim Bergreen and Chess Garrison. Gentlemen, how are we today?
Doing well. Bright and early on a Monday. Good to see you guys.
Chess, how are you?
Yeah, doing well.
A lot of exciting stuff. It's been a while since we've talked to our audience. To kick things off, I thought that we would discuss whether or not we're going to have a functioning House of Representatives, a functioning Congress for the rest of the year. I, for one, vote that it's possible that Congress is going to be a lot more productive than we had previously thought. I see some sprouts of rationality within the House of Representatives. We can talk a little bit about the supplemental aid bill that passed that, well, frankly, everyone knew was going to happen, but nobody knew how it was going to happen. And now that it's happened, it seems that there is sort of a bipartisan consensus that they like a functioning House of Representatives. That doesn't necessarily mean that policies are going to align with what members think should happen, but there does seem to be some happiness around the idea that, you know, you put the fringes to the side and you let the votes fall where they may, and that spells good things for our clients and for those of us who like to see Congress functioning. So with that tee up, Tim, what do you think?
So I think I agree with you to some extent. I think that we're going to see sort of a kind of a political equivalent of the force of gravity, so to speak, start to pull some of the, you know, more cooperation minded Republicans in the House perhaps back closer to their base. You know, there's a sort of interesting constellation, you know, of interest here, where you have sort of mainstream Republicans who have decided that going to the public without having accomplished anything is not a recipe for success in November. You also have these three supplementals, the Ukraine supplemental, the Israel supplemental, and then the Indo-Pacific supplemental, all of which kind of had a, you know, a peak of interest and external events that drove both parties to cooperate at the last minute. Having said that, it was nice to see Congress behaving the way that Congress used to behave.
Chess, what do you think?
I've sort of been debating internally whether that was, to use a law school phrase, whether it was a, you know, the passage of the package was a sui generis event, a one of a kind thing that sort of was a unique set of circumstances that led to it, or whether it's a blueprint for future cooperation. You know, having worked in the Hill for a long time, you know, sometimes bipartisan legislating can beget more bipartisan legislating as people sit in a room together for a long period of time and realize they don't actually hate each other and they kind of agree on a set of things and like the process of negotiating, legislating. So, you know, the optimist in me says that, you know, maybe this is now, you know, Johnson and the Republicans in the House have figured out a way to manage the Freedom Caucus. You know, we'll see, this could all get blown up and there's a motion to vacate filed, you know, in 10 hours or something. But for now, it seems like there is a way to sort of, the more rational heads can prevail in the House. And I think the Senate is desperate to do stuff. And, you know, I talked with a number of Senate chiefs of staff on the Democratic side, and they all said, you know, if anything passes the House with a bipartisan vote, the Senate sort of takes notice and almost feels obligated to do something on it because, you know, it just has not been the MO for the House the last 2 years. So, you know, on the positive side, I think that if the House can get its act together and can pass some stuff and figure out a way to deal with the Freedom Caucus, you know, I think they will find a willing partner in the Senate to actually move things towards enactment.
Those are both very smart analysis, and I think you're both spot on. I do think that we perhaps may be looking at this a little too cynically, number one, and number two, you know, a little too clinically. By that I mean, you know, I don't necessarily, Tim, think that, you know, the House acted rationally Right. As much as, you know, they figured out, you know, how to function within a very chaotic environment. Right. And, you know, how it came together, whether that was somebody plotting a strategy and whether that was, you know, a well thought out plan or not, is not as relevant to the fact that now members of Congress have seen what a final product looks like. Right. And I'm not, you know, there's been a lot written in the press about how Johnson came to this situation, how Schumer and McConnell came to this situation. And I think all of that is correct. But that's like looking back, you know, I think the press and people in Washington are making too much about how this came about and making it sound like it was some sort of plotted strategy, when in fact, I think it was just chaos. And I think it was just members of Congress sort of at their wits' end. And part of it was also luck. And part of it was also, as you mentioned, Tim, external events that drove this. I don't necessarily think this is a learned behavior. I think this is just, you know, it's sort of like a hockey player, right? Like you put the puck down and you get it in the net and you ask him, how'd you do that? And he said, I don't know.
Well, we learned something else, though. We learned that Speaker Johnson actually is educable, right? At a time when a lot of politicians on both sides, you know, take an opinion and no matter what evidence is presented to the contrary, they stick with it. He was presented by the intelligence community with a lot of evidence of the current situation on the battlefield in Ukraine and admitted that things were dire and that it was actually in the national interest to go ahead and pass that package of funding. And that was actually an important demonstration of leadership at a time when it's really been lacking in the House, especially on the Republican side.
I think that's a great point. But I also think that, you know, in conversations with chiefs of staff and other people, you know, in the House of Representatives, you know, I do think that we are underestimating how frustrated a chunk of members on both sides were over the first motion to vacate, right? And it was less about like, we got to get rid of the Republican speaker. We like, we don't like, you know, the speaker, like who's going to be next, and more about the fact that, you know, they had to go home and sort of like, you know, face their constituents with a literal non-functioning House of Representatives, right? So I think that there's a group of people that were sort of like, okay, I get it. I may not like the Speaker Johnson. I may like Speaker Johnson, but I don't want to spend another 3 weeks or 4 weeks or however long sort of with a, you know, speaker, you know, pro tem or whatever his title was, and, you know, and our inability to pass legislation, right? Like, because at the end of the day, you know, they have to get reelected, and like all of us who have bosses, we actually have to show results, right? And you can't really, you know, make the case that you're doing something if the House isn't functioning. So I suspect that this feeling among members is going to protect Speaker Johnson sort of moving forward, not because all of a sudden there's a bunch of Democrats that like him, and not because all of a sudden there's a bunch of Republicans, you know, who want to work with Democrats on it, but because they all have to protect their jobs. And in order to have a job, you have to have a functioning House. But we will certainly find out.
And, you know, all of this is taking place in the context of a presidential election that is turning out to be just as chaotic and sort of unpredictable as folks had thought it might be. You know, you've got the sort of split screen of Joe Biden, you know, going around the country holding rallies and, you know, speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on the one hand, and then you have Trump in the courtroom in New York on the other. And actually, there's a third screen, which I guess is the Supreme Court, which looks set to pretty much kick off any federal trials until next year at the earliest. Wondering what you guys are thinking about this circus that's evolving.
I mean, I think in ways it is a circus, and it's certainly unprecedented having a presidential candidate simultaneously, you know, defending his livelihood and freedom in a courtroom. But that is where we are. But, you know, as chaotic and strange as it seems, I don't think our core or my core analysis hasn't shifted that it's going to come down to, you know, 100,000 votes split across six or seven states that are, you know, have sort of determined the fate of the presidency for the last few election cycles. So, you know, I do think I'm interested to see whether, you know, progressives and younger voters come home to Biden in the end when forced with the sort of ultimate choice between, you know, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, who I think they have some policy disagreements with, but at the end of the day would probably prefer over a Trump presidency again. And likewise on the Republican side, when actually faced with the decision to vote for Biden or not vote, you know, circle in the presidency on your ballot, are Republicans and sort of never Trumpers going to eventually, you know, come home to the fact they may not like Trump personally and the way that he sort of operates, but, you know, prefer his policies and sort of come home to Trump. So that's, you know, a long way winded way of saying that as crazy as this all seems, I don't think our core analysis or my core analysis hasn't shifted.
I think that's right. I think that's the right analysis. I'm also exhausted already in thinking about what this election may or may not do, especially if you consider my theory and, you know, my bottom line analysis, which is, you know, this election's actually not going to shape up until September, right? And between now and then, it's just exhausting to listen to all of the, you know, could have, should have, maybes, you know, what ifs, you know, because in fact, you know, we know this for a fact, right? Joe Biden is going to be on the ballot. Donald Trump is going to be on the ballot, no matter what anybody thinks. And we also know that this is going to be the exact same election that was litigated in 2020. And we know that both candidates are after the same exact, you know, 3,000 voters in Pennsylvania, you know, 9,000 voters in Michigan, right? And, you know, give or take a couple of them who, you know, some that turned 18, some that expired in the last 4 years. But, you know, it's like we're in the exact same spot, right? You know, can Joe Biden win? Yeah, he can win. He won in 2020. Can Donald Trump win? Yeah, he almost won in 2020. So it is exhausting to think about all the drama between now and then, when in fact, I think we're heading to a really close election, and it's best for people to, you know, stay hydrated and try not to lose too much sleep between now and then.
So the big difference, I guess, between 2020 and now, kind of, I guess, politically, right, is that 2020 was pre-Dobbs. And, you know, I guess this is going to be sort of the third election or so that we've had since that decision was handed down. And it seems to be the gift that keeps on giving for Democrats, and wondering whether you think that that is going to end up being, you know, dispositive again this year. And, you know, what does the Florida, you know, situation mean? I mean, is it possible that Florida is in play now, given the situation down there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly has been a boon for Democrats, although, you know, Democrats probably prefer not to have it and still have Roe in place. That said, you know, I think that another critical difference, though, this time is that, state the obvious, Trump is not the incumbent anymore. And if there is a strong anti-incumbent vibe amongst the voting electorate, you know, is that going to then sort of be a headwind to Biden? You know, Trump certainly is more comfortable running as sort of an outsider, despite the fact he's a former president. And I think, you know, to the extent that voters are sort of looking around and grocery prices are still high in September or October, and the price of gas is going up, you know, are they going to vote out Biden because of that? And then that's sort of, Trump is more than willing to play the outsider card and sort of position himself that way.
I agree with everything that's been said. And I would, you know, at the end of the day, if you look at not the polls are moving forward, but if you look at the data of what's actually occurred in elections, so it's actual real data, you know, Democrats have done well, and they've done particularly well after Dobbs, and I think that trend is going to continue. You know, Will we see that reflected in the polls? No, because we didn't see it reflected in the polls in the last couple of elections. It was more anecdotal in terms of organizing, in terms of, you know, who was active in primaries, who was active in the primary electorate. But we're not going to see that in polls. So we're not going to see anything that makes us feel better about the election. But Tim, you're absolutely right. If you look at two things, one, which is that every poll's been wrong, you know, probably since 2016, but not wrong, totally wrong, but, you know, but they're not as predictive as people think they are. But the one thing we do know is that Democrats overperform the polls for a variety of reasons. So there's reason to feel good about it, but it's still going to be a very close election, in my opinion.
So what about the undercard? You know, I think the kind of conventional wisdom about Congress for, you know, the last couple of years has been that both houses may be poised to flip. And I think that, you know, that seems to be the way that things are playing out at this early stage. You gentlemen, keep a closer eye on things in the senior circuit. How's the Senate race shaping up in this fall?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats that I've spoken to are, obviously it's a difficult map for Democrats with, I think they're defending like 23 or 24 seats and in a number of, you know, battleground states. But, you know, the Democrats I've spoken with and folks at the DSCC think that it's, you know, we have battle-hardened candidates like John Tester and Sherrod Brown, who have won in difficulty, won in their states for a number of terms. Obviously, this is a presidential year, so I think sort of the wild card is whether Biden is a net positive or a drag on candidates that have traditionally performed well in sort of not hardcore blue states. That said, you know, it is a really tough map. I think we'll see if Republicans have learned their lesson and sort of started to recruit better candidates that are more viable statewide. Rather than, you know, ones that can survive a primary and sort of cater to the Trump base. So I don't know if you see it any differently.
I think that's spot on. I think that the map is difficult for Democrats. You know, the only caveat on the Senate side is that, candidates really do matter on the Senate side. And you really don't have a good sense as to whether somebody is a good or bad candidate until probably closer to September. You know, so on paper right now, things look good for Republicans. You know, I would bet that things are going, that they're going to pick up the majority in the Senate by one or two, you know, seats. But also it's worth thinking about the future, right? Which is, if they don't pick it up this time, they're never going to pick it up, right? Because the map moving forward looks incredibly complicated for Republicans. So this is their last best shot. And I don't think they get anywhere even close to having 60 votes. And as we all know, you know, the Senate is a body that works by Senate magic, and when Senate magic is not present, you know, and you don't have 60 votes, it's a really frustrating place. And then just to transition really quickly, and we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about the House, but, you know, I think in the House of Representatives, I think that that Democrats are poised to take back the majority by a handful of votes. You know, I think that this is a place where how the top of the ticket does may lift it into double digits. But yes, I think Democrats are poised to take back the House, certainly based on the current environment.
So I guess before we close the books on this current Congress, there is still 8 months left, 7 months left in the year. What do you guys see as the prospects for, you know, future legislating this year? If there is any, is everything going to be on hold till the election? Sort of how do you guys see the next few weeks or next few months playing out on the Hill?
So they're coming back today, I believe, for a 4-week stretch. And this is, you know, and we're all Hill veterans, right? Like May, June, and July were not happy months. And you work really hard. And they're going to do that. The Armed Services Committees in both houses are going to do the NDAA. That'll almost certainly come to the floor at some point this summer, at least on the House side. The appropriations bills, you know, will go through the committee process, certainly in both chambers, and the House may bring a bunch of them to the floor in July. And then, you know, there will be a bunch of other legislation. I imagine there'll be a bunch of messaging bills. They've been going after appliances recently, and I imagine there'll be a bunch of other stuff. But mixed in among that is going to be some serious bills related to China and other issues, which may not get finished until after the election, but which will move along in both chambers. So kind of looping back to the discussion that openness is that, you know, we are sort of in a period where there is some trade space on both sides to do things.
I think going back to where we started this conversation, you know, in terms of, you know, do we have a functioning Congress? Do we have a functioning House? Your other sprouts of rationality, you know, or whether the gravitational pull of politics is going to tear down the institution once again. I believe that it's that this Congress can be more productive, certainly is going to be more productive than I would have predicted 3 months ago. And I believe that you're going to start to see a semblance of, you know, the old days when, you know, within the House and the Senate, you know, the Republicans weren't necessarily the enemies of the Democrats and vice versa, but rather the enemies of the House of Representatives or the Senate and vice versa. So I think that if you're in the House of Representatives, I think it's possible that you're starting to wake up saying, like, this is wonderful. We get to jam the Senate. Like, it's been a long time since we've been able to jam the Senate. If we put together something that even resembles a bipartisan bill, like, the Senate almost has to take it up, right? And, you know, when's the last time that the House of Representatives was jamming the Senate like that, right? So it's, you know, again, I mean, perhaps it's a forgotten muscle, you know, perhaps it's gone into atrophy, but, you know, that tends to bring some energy to the House of Representatives. And I do think that some of the big bills that are out there, whether it's the Farm Bill, the FAA, NDAA, you know, I think some of those will get some traction before lame duck, and certainly I think we'll have a very exciting lame duck like we always predict.
Yeah, and I think not only does the Senate have to take up what the House does, but they're also very hesitant to make changes and risk sending a bill back to the Senate, back to the House, and trying to go through the House process again. So I think, you know, not only does the House get to set the terms of the agenda that's being debated in the Senate, but it also gets to set sort of the policies. I think you saw that on the TikTok bill that was included in the national security supplemental, that, you know, the Senate probably would have preferred to make some more changes to it, but I think they were loath to risk ping-ponging it back to the House and having it sort of die on the floor there.
Which I believe is the textual definition of jamming the Senate. Right.
Yes.
And Tim, I mean, you know, like, you know, we're highfalutin Senate guys, for the purposes of this discussion. And, you know, perhaps we're wrong, but, you know, it just seems like there's some bipartisan high fives every time the House jams the Senate.
Oh, I think, you know, there's always been institutional rivalry. I think that's a polite way of putting it. And I think that there is, you know, anything that brings people together over on the House side is a good thing. And if it takes hating on the Senate, so be it.
Yeah, I mean, it looks but I do think that, you know, I do think that there are some big pieces of legislation out there that, you know, that rationally, if you sit down and you think about whether or not they're going to get done, the answer is they're absolutely going to get done, right? So let's take the Farm Bill, for example. Of course, the Farm Bill is going to get done. And of course, you know, of course, they're not going to cut, you know, all the things that they want to cut. They're not going to add all the things that they want to add. It's going to look almost exactly like the previous Farm Bill. And at the end of the day, it's going to pass at the last second, and it's going to have some bipartisan support. Right now, whether or not people want to sit here and argue and sort of project that there's dysfunction to the world, nobody can control that. But I mean, you know, it's going to get done. It's going to get done at some point. You know, FAA is going to get done. It's going to get done at some point. There's so many of those bills out there right now that, I think we might be in for a surprise, maybe in the next 4 weeks, certainly by the fall before the elections. But I could be wrong.
I'd also add that there's a lot of retiring senior members that want their legacy projects and priorities passed. I mean, I think you have, that chair of ENC, the chair of House Financial Services retiring. They're both maybe trying to collaborate in a data privacy bill that could be added to an NDA or something after the election. So, legacy projects are important to outgoing members. And maybe because of the dysfunction in Congress, we have a lot more outgoing members this year, it seems. So that's, another area that we're there, I think, or maybe fertile ground for legislating for the price of the year.
And then also, given the fact that there's sort of pent up legislative demand, so to speak, there's a lot of ideas that have been unacted upon for a long time. And so this is an opportunity for legislators to do what they like to do, which is legislate.
So it sounds like we're a trio of hopeful guys for what's ahead in Washington, D.C. Let's hope that we are correct. Anything else before we sign off, gentlemen?
Nope, that's it for me on a Monday morning.
Tim?
Nothing for me.
All right. So that's Chess Garrison, Tim Bergreen, and yours truly, Ivan Zapian. We're the trio of Democrats from the Government Relations and Public Affairs team at Hogan Lovells. And that's it. That's all. It's the life we've chosen for ourselves. It's politics. It's Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening.